Well, good evening. Thank you for coming. We are in Habakkuk chapter 1. We're going to finish up last week, verses 2, 3, and 4. There's six words I want to look at. There's three sets of pairs of words to kind of set the stage for Habakkuk's complaint. And then we're going to read through the Lord's first answer and get started on verse 5, because there's a lot of things within there. Some very important things as far as the progress of salvation, us understanding and being things being revealed to us. I think the greatest thing that as I was studying for tonight that began to become clear, and sometimes you maybe see it right away, and we've already talked about it, but Habakkuk is looking at things in his culture, and he sees, from his position, he sees wrong. He sees the violence and the lawlessness, and he goes to God and says, why are you not doing something? Do you not see what I see? And now, that's ridiculous to think that, because God is the one who's holy, and so he can see, you know, the smallest wrong, the smallest evil. And yet we are evil creatures. And when we can say, oh, look, I see wrong, I mean, how blatant is that wrong? So when you go to God and say, don't you see this? Obviously God sees it, and he sees much more. In fact, he sees the problem as much worse than Habakkuk can even identify. Habakkuk's in arms, like, this is terrible. And God's looking down, and basically it's like, okay, yeah, you don't even understand how bad it is. And then he's going to provide him an answer. Here's what I'm doing about it. And just like God's ability to see so much more of the evil compared to Habakkuk's ability to understand and perceive the evil, Habakkuk wants an answer. So he sees a little bit of the problem, so he's asking for, in a sense, a little bit of an answer. And God says, well, wait a minute. I'm going to tell you something. I see a much bigger picture, and I've got an answer, and I'm working on the answer. But if I told you the answer, you would not even be able to process it. You'd just be amazed. You'd be astounded. So get ready. I'm going to tell you the answer. And when Habakkuk hears the answer, it's like, oh, my gosh. I mean, it's like, that's not the answer. The problem's here, and you're answering this. It's like God says, you're going to have to trust me on this, because if I drop down to your level and start solving all of your little problems, I would never deal with the overall problem. So Habakkuk is seeing a part of the problem, and he wants this one answer. God is saying, I see the whole problem, and I'm giving you a whole answer. Now, while I give you the whole answer, you're still going to have to deal with this problem. And that kind of gives you a tension or a perspective of what's going on. So here we go ahead and read chapter 1, verses 2, 3, and 4, Habakkuk's complaint. And remember, this complaint is a lament. It's a prayer. He's crying out. And God is not going to rebuke him for his complaint. He's just going to tell him, you don't understand the answer I'm going to give you, or that I'm what I'm doing. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen, or cry out to you violence, but you do not save or deliver? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict. Here's our list. There is strife and conflict. Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. Two things that you're going to see in that verse. Violence. He is concerned about the violence that he is seeing in the culture. And he's concerned with the lack of law, or we'll just say lawlessness. And these are the two pertinent issues. There's violence and there's lawlessness. And just to give you a heads up where this is going to go, in his answer, God is going to say, I'm going to bring in the Babylonians, a very violent people. For the lawlessness, I'm bringing in the Babylonians, who are a law unto themselves. They don't follow any laws. They make their own laws when they show up. So in other words, his answer is going to be, Habakkuk's complaining about violence in Judea, and God says, I'm going to bring in violence that's going to overwhelm that violence. What about the lawlessness in Judea? I'm going to bring in the Babylonians who don't follow any law. They are a law unto themselves. They make it up as they go, if you want to say it that way. It's like, well, that's not the answer to the problem. And it's like, yes, it is. He says, I'm doing a work. And so that's kind of where his answer is. Here's the Lord's answer. When Habakkuk asked these questions, and do notice, he's saying, Habakkuk had said things like, look, or how long will you make me look? Why do you not see? Why do you not look at? Well, the Lord is going to tell him the very same thing. He's going to say, you look at something. Here it is, chapter 1, verse 5. Look at the nations and watch, and be utterly amazed, for I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe. And right in there, there's a fourfold response in verse 5 we'll get to, where he's saying it within. He doesn't chew them out, say, that's a bad question. Where's your faith? He says, okay, look. I'm going to show you something. It's going to be astounding. It's something that when I explain it to you, when I tell you, you will not believe it. Oh, I've got great faith. Well, let me tell you what I'm going to do. And when I tell you, you won't. You say, that's not what you're doing. Because what God is doing is, in a sense, beyond Habakkuk's theology. And also, one thing we'll say here as I go by this, verse 5, and all these things I'm going to repeat. The word look is in the plural, masculine plural. So he's not saying, look, Habakkuk. He's saying, you all look. So once again, that's very simple to understand because Habakkuk is, it's not just Habakkuk and the Lord. In a sense, that's what we've got, we're reading. But Habakkuk is a prophet. And it's not only Habakkuk's complaint, it's the complaint of a plural. You know. And now again, who are the plural? Is it all Judea? Is it the righteous? And Habakkuk, is it the scoffers and the mockers and Habakkuk? Nonetheless, who Habakkuk is representing, we'll just say to start with, the nation as their prophet. And so he's got a complaint for himself and the people. And then the Lord responds in verse 5, look, and he's responding plurally to not just the man Habakkuk, but to the people Habakkuk's representing. If it be the righteous in Judea, if it be all Judea. Some, you know, as they work through this, say it's the scoffers, you know, look and be amazed, you scoffers. I don't think that's what it is. I think he's talking to a man of faith, and that's where he's going to end up saying, the righteous will live by faith. You're going to have to trust me because you're not going to understand everything. Just like we've talked about, the things revealed belong to us and to our children. The secret things belong to the Lord. Nonetheless, look at the nations and watch. And be utterly amazed, for I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe. And it's fourfold. Look, watch, be utterly amazed. And if I am going to do something that you would not believe. And it doesn't say it's possible. He says, no, I am going to do something that when I tell you what I'm going to do, you will not believe that this is my answer to your problem. Then here's the answer. Now he begins the answer. I am raising up the Babylonians or Chaldeans. That now he describes them, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth and seize dwelling places not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves. There's that mention of law. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture swooping to devour. They all come, all that description, they're coming like lions and leopards. They're hawks and birds and, you know, tanks. They're just coming and they're doing exactly what they want. And they're all coming to do this one thing. Look at verse 9. They all come bent on Hamas. So Habakkuk's complaining about Hamas, the violence, and lawlessness. God says, I'm going to tell you something. You won't believe it, but this is what I'm doing. I'm bringing in a people who are a law to themselves, and they're not going to do anything with your law. They're going to make their own. And I'm bringing in a people to deal with your violence, a people that is far more violent, a people that are they bent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They deride kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at the fortified cities. They build earthen ramps and capture them. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on. Guilty men. Now again, he's not praising them. I mean, all these things they're doing, and what about them? They're guilty. They are wrong. They're guilty. Whose strength is their God. In other words, they're all just bent on their own human effort, their own human desire, and they are wrong. Now, eventually, and we're going to have a chance to look at a verse in Isaiah where Assyria is called, referred to Isaiah 10, is described almost identical or the same set. Isaiah describes his culture. God describes the Assyrians that are going to be coming in. And then the next thing is they're described as how wicked the Assyrians are and how they're going to be judged. And that's where this book is going to go. Chapter 2 is going to talk about how these people are going to be judged. But right now, they're going to be used as God's tool as he moves through history. In other words, God is using people throughout history, nations that maybe don't know him, that are, you know, against his will, but he's using them to manipulate and position, cause kingdoms to fall, kingdoms to rise. But in the end, they are guilty and they will be punished as he uses them. I mean, God is using Satan. God is using nations. God is using leaders. I mean, we've got to believe that we have a sovereign God that is in control and that anyone that is in power is not out of control. They are being used by God for a purpose. We may think they're out of control, but when God is done with them, he will disperse with them. They'll be moved out. Individuals will be moved out. Nations will be moved out. Even Satan himself will be moved out when the time is complete. And again, now, for example, this goes back to my original point. If I were God, that's not what I would do. If I were God, I would make sure Satan doesn't get in the Garden of Eden. I mean, it's like, I mean, how simple is that? You've got a sovereign Lord with all power, and he makes a beautiful garden, puts man in there and Eve in there, and then here comes Satan. It's like, oh, who left the gate open? It's like he allowed that. I mean, this whole process is God is controlling things. I'm not talking about predestination, but I am talking about God is allowing things to happen so he can work his plan. That deals with Satan, that deals with nations, that deals with rulers, that deals with people and situations in our own life. It's like, why is this not fixed? It's like we're going somewhere. So Habakkuk can be addressed as a cultural, national thing, but you can see even individual lives can be seen apply this principle. God is doing something. And that's why in this book it says the righteous must live by faith, because you cannot understand God's great answer because you cannot fully understand how great the problem is. I know there's a problem. I see a problem in my life. I see a problem in the world. I can identify problems, you know, in our culture. But that's me, a fallen creature, identifying problems. The problem is bigger than that, which means the answer has to be bigger than I can imagine. I can identify the problem, and I can say, this is what I would do to fix it, but I'm just talking about this little problem that I can identify with a little bit of understanding that I've got. God sees a much bigger problem, and he's got an all-encompassing answer. In fact, we can say this confidently, that when this process of salvation is finished... And it's not. I mean, Jesus Christ has died. He's been resurrected. He says it is finished. But obviously, it's still working out. I mean, we're still heading towards the end. The victory's been won, but we're still heading towards the final buzzer when we celebrate. And you can celebrate ahead of time. You know you're going to win. But in the end, there is going to be, understand this, there's going to be no death. Death is going to be over. It's going to be done. Just like the kingdoms will turn to dust and be blown away, and it will be replaced by something completely new, death will be completely removed. Sin will be completely gone. It won't be something we've got control of. Sin won't even be an option. Daniel talks about ushering in everlasting righteousness. It's going to be the kingdom of righteousness. It's going to be righteousness. There's nothing but positive, nothing but production, nothing but righteousness. There's no death, there's no sin. And it's not something that God is not going to allow. It's going to be destroyed. It's not going to be able to creep in somehow because it doesn't exist. It's going to cease to be there. Death, the final enemy, will be conquered. And so we would like to see our lives extended. We'd like to see our bodies healed. And God extends life. God heals the body. God brings good things in life. God created the universe, so there's good things here. But everything here is temporal. We are going to a place where it's not even an issue. God is going to be absolute righteousness in our presence, and we're going to be absolute righteousness in His presence. We can't even imagine these things. That's why at the end of Revelation, when they describe it, it's descriptive, and we can get our hands on it or touch it, but you can't fully understand. And that's what God is saying right here, is He's just not going to punish Judah and get them back on the right track. He's going to do something that's amazing throughout with the nations. So here we go, back to Habakkuk's complaint. I want to talk about these words to describe his culture. Again, notice he says, "How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you don't listen, or cry for violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong?" So again, he's saying, I'm looking at these things, and I'm seeing these things. You're looking at these things, you're tolerating. And then here comes your set of words right here. Iniquity and wrong. And I've got these on the bottom of page 3 from last week's notes. And the word iniquity, it's partnered with, see, iniquity and wrong, but they're all individual words, but I think we've got three steps, a process. Iniquity, it means trouble, sorrow, wickedness, from the root word that indicates vain attempt and a fruitless effort. So this iniquity is trouble, it's fruitless. And that is, that's what he says, I'm looking at this iniquity, or I'm looking, let me look here on page 3 at the top. Why do you make me see iniquity is in the English Standard Version. And then see iniquity, and why do you idly look at wrong? I'm seeing iniquity, and you are idly, God, the Lord, is idly looking at wrong. Wrong is trouble, labor, toil. We'll say labor, toil. Is the word, comes from a wearing effort and wearisome toil. So this is weary. So God is watching this labor, this weariness, this wrong. It's nothing's getting done. It's just spinning wheels. They work, 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 and nothing changes. Why do you just watch? We go on year after year, day after day, almost like Solomon, vanity, vanity. Everything is meaningless. It's just labor. It's wrong. It doesn't work. And he says, I'm looking at fruitlessness, trouble. Why do we see? We're both seeing this iniquity and this wrong. So why do I see this? Why do you idly look at it? And then he describes, we can't fix anything. Then he describes the next, destruction and violence are before me. So because nothing's working, we have destruction and violence, and there's our word Hamas. The word destruction is the word shod. It means violence itself. Devastation, ruin. The word is a social sin and the ruin of a nation in the prophets. The prophets refer to that. So this again is destruction. It involves social. It involves the disfall of a nation, a society. It's just, again, collapsing in on itself and the violence with devastation and ruin. The next word, violence. Is the word Hamas. It, again, means violence or wrong. This is cruelty. This, we can say, is injustice. And it is a social sin. This is social chaos where society now, because of iniquity, there's trouble, there's fruitlessness, that's wearisome, nothing gets done. Now the nation itself is in destruction. Violence sets in, social injustice is there. And so now you've got a society that's eating itself because nothing's working out. And that leads to this. The next two words. Let me read them here in the English Standard. It says, why do you make me see iniquity, and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me, and now strife and contention arise. Everything's falling apart. Nothing's working. Society now turns on itself. There's social sin, injustice. It's a collapse. It's destruction. It's the ruin of our society. And as that's happening now, what sets in arises. Strife and contention. And here it is, the word strife, rib in the Hebrew, R-I-B, it means strife, dispute. It refers to contention, controversy with an adversary or conflict. In a controversy, it's a legal suit. So this strife is a dispute. Disputes arise. Legal cases arise. Now, this is not the first time we've seen this in the prophets. That's when people go to court. Because nothing's working. It's fruitless. We're worrisome. We've got all kinds of trouble. We can't get anything to function. So now you've got to start fighting and trying to survive. Society turns on itself, starts destroying itself. There's injustice. There's social sin. That's not fair. Contentions arise. That's these two words right here. Contention and strife. So now disputes arise. Legal situations come in. We need this fixed. We're going to go to court where this is, you're not treating me fair because it doesn't work. You're abusing me. I'm going to court to get this straightened out. And then that's strife. Contention means strife, contention. This is brawling, contention, or quarreling. So because of this right here, this strife and contention arise, and they're going to go to court, and they're going to, this is fighting. This is injustice and abuse. This is everything's falling apart and not working. So it's not working. We're going to become unjust to try to fix our part of it. That's going to make someone mad. You're going to have quarreling and contention and strife, ending up in the lawsuits. Now that leads us to the next verse, verse 4. So the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. Once you get down here, once you get to this point right here, because we get here, there's strife and contention in the courts. There's injustice. The courts aren't going to solve anything. Society can't fix itself. It's broken completely. And so because of that, the law is paralyzed. And again, the word paralyzed, you can see it there. It's 0.4A3, paralyzed. The word comes from the root word pug, which means to grow numb. The law is numb. It ceases. In Strong's Concordance, it means cease, to be feeble, faint, to be slack. So the law, paralyzed is a good word. The law, we go to the law, but the law is numb. It has no feeling, has no response, has nothing. And you can see even in our own case, in our situation, in our we're still stopping at stop signs. I mean, when we start driving through stoplights and we're not following basic traffic laws, we're in a huge, huge problem. But so far in West Des Moines, we still have traffic lights. But you can see in certain places where law is breaking down, the court systems are failing. How far is that going to go? In this case right here, in Habakkuk's culture, the law is paralyzed. Culture's not working. Injustice sets in. They go to the law, but all it is quarreling and fighting in courts. No one gets resolved. What's going to happen here? The elite are going to get their way. The law is paralyzed, and what happens then? The law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. Coming out of these court cases, there is justice, no justice. It never. You go to the law. Go to the court. The legal situation. The decision is made, or it's paralyzed. The truth doesn't come out, and justice is never handed out. It's the elite maintain control, maintain power. Justice never goes forth. I write these things. Justice is the legal process and the function of government. So all this is the institution of government is totally failing, which would mean individual responsibility has collapsed, marriage, family has collapsed, government has collapsed. Now the nation is going to collapse. Since there is lawlessness, it is obvious that justice never manifests. Justice is perverted instead of being carried out. So whenever there is any kind of a decision that is handed down, it's the wrong decision. It goes right back to this. This social injustice, this Hamas, manifests in the court system as more social violence, injustice. Now, that's his complaint. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. And so if you're trying to be a righteous man in this society, you're hemmed in. There's nowhere to go. You're hemmed in. There's a fence around you. If you're trying to live righteous, you're trapped. You can never win. You can never win in this culture doing the right thing. Now, again, in the scope of things, in history, as God sees things, you don't pay back evil with evil. You continue to do good. We're told that. That's one of the things we're commanded to do in a generation like this, is you continue to do good. You continue to let the light shine. But understand, that's your commitment to God. That's you trying to shine a light in the darkness and bring people to God. That's you doing the right thing in a society that is doing the wrong thing. But the society itself is not going to respond. You're hemmed in, and you're always going to get burnt in the end. I think in our culture, there's still light. There's still hope. You can still do nice things. I checked out bought a couple boards today at Home Depot to finish a little portion of the deck Tyler and I are putting on. And I pushed them up there, and there's no tag on them. There's no tag. She couldn't scan them. So it's like, she asked me, how much are they? So I said, 50 cents a piece. I was joking. And I said, I'll be right. I'll go, do you remember how much they were? I said, 50 cents. And I laughed. I said, I'll go back and check. I said, I didn't remember. So I went back and I pulled off a little tag off one of the other boards, walked up and says, they're $13.46. I said, here's the tag. And she scanned it. It was $13.46. Now, again, that was, she trusted me at the checkout. I did the right thing, and that's, in an absolute lawless situation, there'd be nothing on the shelves. I mean, it'd all be stolen already. It'd be gone. And you see that happening already in our nation. So again, in my little world, there's still light. There's still hope. There's still law. There's still decency. There's still integrity. But Habakkuk is in a situation where they're in, again, about where we are at before 586. If he's in, 606, like we say 606, they're going to, total destruction is 586. They're about 20 years out. So he's looking at it in his society. And we can go places in our own culture and say these very things. In my little world, it's still sunshine and roses. But I see things on the news, if the news is true, that the law is paralyzed. Justice never goes forward. The last place you want to go is to court in some states because it's not going to work out. Well, anyway, here's the Lord's answer. It says this, and now we're going to start on the next set of notes, just the one page. He says, chapter 1, verse 5, look at the nations and watch. And be utterly amazed, for I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe even if you were told. So several things God does not do. He does not rebuke Habakkuk. He does not correct Habakkuk and say, well, no, you're all wrong. It's not as bad. You got to have a positive attitude. Always look on the sunshiny side of things. It's like he says, no, I apparently he understands. He agrees, except he knows the problem's much worse. He doesn't rebuke Habakkuk for coming to him because that's a sign of faith. It's like, I understand. That's what you do. I mean, your kids do that. Students in school do that. It's like, I don't understand this problem. You didn't explain it right. They may accuse the teacher. I mean, they don't know. They don't always know how to say they don't understand it. You didn't tell me this. I did tell you this, but you don't have the ability to understand it, child. So the child will say to the teacher, you didn't explain it. Well, yes, I did. But you can't understand it, so let's go back. So as a teacher, you understand those things. The kid accusing you is not necessarily accusing you. They're just throwing out their perspective, or your child at home, or anybody. And so when Habakkuk says, why do you idly look at this violence, this wrong? Well, God does say, stop talking to me like that. Well, the very fact Habakkuk's talking to him and asking, he's putting two and two together, or two and one together, and getting seven because he's got this much information. This is a common thing. There's evil in the world, and there's a sovereign God over all. Why does God not destroy evil? I mean, everyone should ask that. Why did God put Satan in the garden? Why did God allow evil? Why doesn't God just fix everything? Well, that's a good question. I mean, you at least have faith in God. Says, I think God could fix it. So you go to God, why? And he'll say, okay, that's a good question. And here we go. I can't just tell you the answer because I can't just jump into calculus. But here we go. One, two. And he starts, and as you go through things, the righteous will live by faith. You know there's a God and you understand this. So now you're going to understand, trust all this other stuff. The righteous will live by faith. You're going to just have to trust God in this. Now, I'm not talking about blind faith. I'm talking about faith in a God that you understand some about him. You understand this. So when he says you won't understand this, trust me, you'll have faith. And as you go through life, you continue to add to your repertoire of things. And that's what's happening to Habakkuk and the people of Judah right now. Is they're coming. So God's not rebuking. He doesn't say, shut up, stop talking to me like that. He says, look. look at the nations. Now, plural. This look is plural, and this would probably be referring to Habakkuk, obviously, but I'm just going to say Judah, all the people of Judah. Maybe it's only the righteous that are asking this question with their prophet Habakkuk. Maybe it's everyone. Let's just say Judah for now. Look, Judah, the chosen nation, at the nations, plural, all of the nations. And then they're supposed to look around, I mean, lift your head up and look at the bigger picture. We've got a problem. Why don't you fix our problem? Why don't we have righteousness in our... He says, look at the nations. In other words, the chosen nation is going to be looking at all the nations. And then out of that nation, the nations, he's going to mention the Babylonians. But he's not mentioning that yet. He just says, look among the nations and see. That's your second one. See, look, see. And then, I haven't figured this out. If you look at this, it says, wonder and be astounded. That's the English Standard translation. And I know you've got the Masoretic text, that is the Hebrew coming, that's been handed down. And then you've got the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation. And there is some, in this verse, there's some, interesting, especially in the Dead Sea Scrolls, some of their commentary on this. When they commentate, they've got the same verses, but the Dead Sea Scrolls skip, they don't even talk about Babylon. They go right to start talking about the Romans. You know, I'm raising up the Babylonians. Well, they start talking about the Romans in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, they don't change the text, but they go right, just like we would say, you know, we read the text of Scripture and then we apply it to our own lives, what's going on in America. This verse is saying nothing about America, but there's application. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, the scribes, read this verse and right away started talking about Rome. So in all of that, here's my question. I'm going to read Hebrew there, the transliteration, and just the words, reading backwards, of course. Look among the nations and watch. Okay, there's your word, watch. And be astounded utterly. Okay, so you can say, and be utterly astounded. Now, are they getting two words, utterly and astounded? Is that where they're getting wonder and astounded from up there in the English Standard Version? See, for I will work a work. See, God is going to work a work. He's doing a work. And that this work is, as we get into this later in the book, it's the whole work of salvation. It's the whole plan. It's all of eschatology. He's not just looking at 586 BC. He's doing a work that's tied into a much bigger equation. I will work a work in your days, then there's the negative, not, which you would believe not. So there's a saying, you would not, but you believe not. So there you've got, look, see, I didn't write the word, astounded. I better scribble that, there's a lot of letters in there I can't remember. Be astounded, and then utterly astounded. So there's at least four, I mean, this the point, verse 5 is, I'm going to blow your mind. I mean, look, see, be utterly astounded. I'm going to tell it to you, and when you hear it, you will not be able to believe it. I'm going to tell you something on the level of faith at level 7 that you're going to say, no, not so, Lord. And the only way you're going to receive that is to say, by faith. The righteous, you understand 1, 2, 3, he's committed to the law of Moses, he's at level 5 or 6, but God's going to take him to level, so maybe he's going to take him to level 12, and say, I'm going to explain level 12 to you, and when I get done explaining to you, you're going to say, no, not so, Lord. Just like Peter, Jesus says, the Son of Man, he's just got, and then, you know, Peter identified him, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Well, I'm going to go to Jerusalem and they're going to execute me. I'm going to be handed over. They're going to spit on me, mock me. They're going to crucify me. And Peter says, no, not so, Lord. No. That's not the plan. Well, Jesus talking at level, 20, And he's just demonstrated, we spent 3 years identifying, you are the Christ. You are the one we've been waiting for. All right, are you ready for the next plan? Yeah, we are. Let's go take the kingdom. And no. I'm going to go and I'm going to die. What? How's that part of the plan? How's that even work? Well, Peter at that point had to become the righteous living by faith. It's like, and he struggled. And did he even get it? I mean, did he even get it until it happened? I mean, he denied Christ. He fought him the whole way. He ran and hid. So you understand, Peter, a man of faith, had to deal with something at level 20 with the Christ that he believed in, knew he was the Christ, followed him, was saved. But the Christ is doing something right here. He says, just like it says here, I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. I'm reading the NIV. I mean, Jesus could have quoted that to Peter at Caesarea Philippi. I'm going to tell you something that's going to happen in your day that you will not believe. No. I'm with you all the way. Tell me. I'm going to go to Jerusalem. They're going to kill me. They're going to crucify me. The Jews are going to hand me over to the Romans who will execute me. No. It's like, you know, it's the same dynamic right there. And Peter crossed over. He processed the answer, and he writes 1st and 2nd Peter. He proclaimed it on the Temple Mount. So Peter is going to understand. He's going to eventually process it. But you got to understand, there's things out there that this is not just to Habakkuk and Judah or Peter. This is to you and me. There's things happening in the world today. There's things happening in my life. The guys say, oh, here's my plan to fix this. It's like, well, that's a stupid plan. That's not even right. That's going the wrong way. It's like, okay, the righteous will live by faith. There comes, now, again, I understand this. I understand this. I can explain this. I'm a Bible teacher, so I can navigate my way through Scripture and make this clear. But eventually, I'm going to run into something that's like, that can't be right. Okay, the righteous will live by faith. You're going to have to, from here, you're just going to have to trust God. All right. So look among the nations and see, wonder, and be astounded, for I'm doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. And so, first of all, this verse right here is not a rebuke. It's not a correction. It's simply saying, I'm going to do something that you can't understand. I'm going to go ahead and tell you, but when I tell you, you're going to fight back. And he does. I mean, you have to have in this book, you have to have verse 12, because God just tells him, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do and you won't believe it. And if in verse 12, Habakkuk goes, oh, okay, that makes sense. Well, then God underestimated Habakkuk. You have to have verse 12 when God gets done explaining it. What's Habakkuk have to say? No. That's ridiculous. I don't believe that. Well, here it is. Here's verse 12. We're way ahead. We'll talk. Oh, Lord, are you not from everlasting? He starts quoting the theology he understands, that you are from everlasting. My God, my Holy One, you are my God. I worship you. My Holy One, you are holy. You're set apart. You're beyond all this. We will not die. I mean, you're not going to kill us, your chosen people. And he gives him 4 points of theology. You are from everlasting. You are my God. You are my Holy One. We will not die. Just like Peter told Jesus, you're not going to die. You're not going to die. We're not going to let you go to Jerusalem and die. Oh, Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment. And that now again, I've got a question mark written in my Bible there, and that's maybe wrong to do so. But when he says, oh, Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment, is it a question mark? Or is he's just stating what the Lord just said. I'm going to judge my people, Judah, with Babylon. And now he says, oh, Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment. O rock, you have ordained them to punish. I got a question mark by both of those in my own Bible. Now, again, that's you should wonder, is he making that a statement of faith? Because that's the information that's beyond, that's the challenge. And verse 13, you know, he says, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. Judah is evil. Fix it. God says, I'm going to appoint the Babylonians to fix it. But he just describes them. He says, they're so evil, they're so wicked, they're so violent. It's like, whoa, you're bringing more violent people in to judge the violent people? So, I mean, you can see that he's processing. He says right here, this is now a question in verse 13. This is a question. In my NIV Bible, they make this a question. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? And that would have to be the Babylonians swallowing up the Judeans. Because Judah is bad, but they're more righteous than the Babylonians. At least we talk about you. And so you can see there's a complaint. But he has to have that complaint. He has to struggle, because if he doesn't struggle, that means, oh, yeah, I understand that. So anyway, let's go back to chapter 1, verse 5. Look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded, for I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if you were told. I think I've got all those things written down. I've said all those things. Look at point 4 on page 1. The reply to Habakkuk's complaint by saying that the Babylonians are being raised up to punish Judah. Isaiah 10. I want to go to Isaiah 10. I said I would. And let's just do that again. This is not like the first time this has come up. Just see how close Isaiah 10 is. And Isaiah is talking about the Assyrians. Isaiah prophesying right here, 600 or 700 down to sometime around 680 sometime. He's talking about the Assyrians are coming. Chapter 10. And I'm going to read the first four verses. The first, Isaiah chapter 10, verse 1 through 4. This is similar to Habakkuk 1 through 3. It actually is a continuation of what's going on in chapter 9, but he's describing the lawlessness of northern Israel. Woe to those, chapter 10, verse 1, woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, there's your Hamas, the fourth generation, to deprive the poor of their rights. And again, the poor is not always the poverty-stricken homeless people. That is, in this case, the middle class that have lost everything to the elite, and they've been oppressed, and so now they're poor. Yeah, they may be in the streets. They may be in poverty. They are in poverty, but they are the middle class that have lost their place. And withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. What will you do on the day of reckoning, when disaster comes from afar? To whom will you run for help? Now he's talking to the elite. Where will you leave your riches? Nothing will remain but to cringe among the captives. And that's what takes place. They're taken off into captivity. Or fall among the slain. You're going to have, you elite in northern Israel are going to have two choices come 722, 725, 724, 723, 722. You're going to have two choices. Go off with the captives or fall with the slain. Okay, because the Assyrians are coming. So that is the complaint, and that's the answer. Now watch this. Chapter 10, beginning in chapter 10, verse 5, he's now going to begin to describe the Assyrians. Woe to the Assyrian, the rod of my anger, in whose hand is the club of my wrath. I send him against a godless nation, that would be Judah, northern Israel also. I dispatch him against a people who anger me, to seize loot and snatch plunder, to trample them down like mud in the streets. But this is not what he intends. Now that's what God sends him. God sends Assyria. But the Assyrian is sinful. The Assyrian is just like the Babylonians. They're guilty. But this is not what he intends. This is not what he has in mind. His purpose is to destroy and to put an end to many nations. Are not my commanders all kings, he says. Has not Kelno fared like Carchemish? Now he's describing all the cities he's conquered and goes on through like this. Now, chapter 10, verse 12. This is what Habakkuk is going to say about the Babylonians. Chapter 10, verse 12. When the Lord has finished all his work against Mount Zion. Notice, the Lord is going to work against Mount Zion. Like he just told Habakkuk, I'm going to do a work against Mount Zion and Jerusalem. He will say, I will punish the king of Assyria for the willful pride of his heart and the haughty look in his eyes, for he says. So in verse 12, now God, he says, when I'm finished using the Assyrians as my striking rod, I will then turn and destroy the Assyrians for their pride, for their sin, for their arrogance. Then he describes, here's what they say, by the strength of my hand I have done this, and by my wisdom, because I have understanding, I removed the boundaries of nations, I plundered their treasures. Now that's exactly what God is going to say in chapter 1, verses 5 through 11 about the Babylonians. So he's describing them in a similar fashion. Verse 14, as one reaches into a nest, so my hand reached for the wealth of the nations. As men gathered abandoned eggs, so I gathered all the countries. Not one flapped a wing or opened its mouth. And then God says, okay, that's what the Assyrian is saying. But then God says, wait, verse 15. Does the axe raise itself above him who swings it? Now here's it very clear, friends. Here in Isaiah and Habakkuk, God is using the nation, the Assyrians or the Babylonians, to accomplish his purpose. And he will move kingdoms and boundaries and people around. But if these people are indeed guilty, if they are indeed sinful, if they do not know the Lord, he'll say to them something similar. Does the axe raise itself above him who swings it, or the saw boast against him who uses it? As if a rod were to weld him who lifts it up, or a club brandish him who is not wood. In other words, there's no Assyria, you are not going to turn. You maybe can destroy my people because I sent you there and used you like a tool against them, but you're not going to raise your hand against me. And the same thing. Therefore, the Lord Almighty, will send a wasting disease upon his sturdy warriors, upon his pomp and fire. And he goes through and talks about all that. And all, both in Habakkuk and in Isaiah, this ends up leading into not just Assyria's fall or Babylon's fall, but it's going to project to the whole plan of God, which ends up in eschatology, ends up in God bringing judgment against all in the end who are opposing him or coming against him. So that's bottom of page one. Go to page two, point five. I just wrote these things here. I think we've already said all this. The Lord is sympathetic with Habakkuk and does not rebuke him. The Lord is aware of the situation and is looking at the problem. In fact, the Lord is more aware. I've said all those things. So the Lord's answer is going to be astonishing. I want to point out in point six, Habakkuk had told the Lord in chapter 1, verse 3, why do you make me see iniquity? Why do you idly look at wrong? Seeing and looking. God replies to him and says chapter 1, verse 5, look among the nations and see. You look and you see. When Habakkuk says, why do I see? Why don't you look? God turns it back at him. You look and you're the one that needs it. Habakkuk says, I'm looking at this. Why aren't you seeing the same thing I'm seeing? And God says, why don't you look at what I'm showing you and see what I'm actually doing? So again, he plays on that. And chapter point seven, violence and law are the two issues. Habakkuk's complaining about violence and law, and I've already said this. Habakkuk complains of violence and that the law is paralyzed. And here's the Lord's answer. Point A, violence for violence. As in 1:2, Habakkuk says, I cry out to you, violence. But the Lord's response in 1:9 is, they all come for violence. You're seeing violence? Well, I'm bringing the Babylonians, and the only reason they're coming is to bring more violence. I'm going to overcome your violence with the Babylonian violence, and then I'm going to punish them for being violent. B, the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. That's what Habakkuk says. The answer the Lord brings is the Babylonians, whose legal decisions are described as, in the English Standard Version, their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. In the NIV, they are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. So just interesting. I mean, right in the front of the book, the violence, and the lawlessness that Habakkuk is complaining about, God says, my answer is the Babylonians. You won't believe this if I told you. I'm going to bring the Babylonians, and for your violence, I'm going to bring in their violence. Their lawlessness, they don't even have a law. They're not going to follow your laws. They're not going to follow my laws. They are a law unto themselves. And so they will disregard all this. I'm going to bring in someone more violent and more lawless or more set in their own law than you. And that's flat out what he's saying there in chapter 1, verse 5 in response as we go through this. I'm going to continue explaining Habakkuk, God's response next week. No, is there class next week? No, there's no class next week. There's no class next week. But there will be class in 2 weeks, I think. So we miss one Tuesday. And so we'll talk about that. And when Tony shows up, I'll clarify that with her. We have no class next Tuesday, right, Tony?
No class the 29th of June or July 6th. So for the next 2 weeks.
So we got 2 weeks with no class. Okay. We'll be back. Okay. Any questions about what we've talked about here this evening? Any thoughts? Again, as we go through this, then, you know, chapter 2, God is going to pronounce the five curses against the Babylonians. He said, you know, he talks about how he's going to use them. But he's not going to let them go unpunished. And then, of course, chapter 3 is Habakkuk just coming to a recognition of, and again, when we talk about Habakkuk, because, you know, God's response is in the plural, I think we're talking about Habakkuk and this group. You know, maybe all of Judea has a chance, but more likely it's the righteous that are going to have to follow this, because they're going to have to live through it. They're so, you know, just like Zephaniah was telling them, you got to prepare their souls. You got to be ready for this. There's no deliverance coming. There's no deliverance. There's only the preparation of your soul and your faith. The Byzantine Empire, or even because the Byzantine Empire extended. I know I looked at that and thought about that. I know the church, some of the early church fathers, well, they wouldn't be the earliest, but like, you know, in 600, 700, they called the rise of Islam, they called it Ishmael and the Antichrist, that this is where the Antichrist comes from. So they recognized the rise of Islam as Antichrist. I'm trying to think, you know, if anything, the church at that time, all that territory that they lost, like in North Africa, was totally lost. All of North Africa was Christian. I mean, from Alexandria, Egypt, all the way across Northern Africa, that was all Christian. And they just killed their way through it and destroyed the church. Right, yeah. And the only thing, you know, the general concept there is, you know, the Catholicism was setting in, you know, Constantine had come in and it Christianized everyone. You know, you've got individuals that, you know, their writings, but I can't tell you how their culture, their churches. Their churches were slipping into the methodology, the liturgy. And it's that tension, you know, during those days of persecution, the first 300 years of persecution, there's still cultish things, the Gnostics, and, you know, John was rejected and stuff. But, you know, the church continued to be strong during those times and expanded. Then once it became a national empire with, you know, Constantine.
But at the same time, that could have been ushering in a sort of a false profession without possessing.
And that indeed, because everyone became Christian. I mean, everybody, you know, entire armies would become Christian by marching through the rivers and being baptized. It became a dead religion, yeah. And correct, right. Yeah, and it became corrupt. Well, Constantine's, his sons, again, I'm talking on the top of my head, there's three sons, Constantius and Constans and, you know, Constantine II or whatever. And they all fought for the kingdom. You know, he's the first Christian emperor, and his son, I wish I had more notes right here available for me. But off the top of my head, there's three sons, and they all were competing. Two of them went to war against each other, and one of them was killed. Another one was killed somehow else, and another one ended up ruling after all of his brothers were killed. So, and then he ends up, and that's when Julian the Apostate, oh, I know what, the one that began ruling ended up killing everyone in his family, all of his uncles, anyone that could claim, and his uncle's sons, all of his nephews, so that no one could claim the throne of Constantine. And one kid escaped, Julian the Apostate, who ended up becoming the next emperor. And he was raised very Christian, would read the scriptures in their churches. But then he swore off, after he saw all that, he swore off. Now we're talking, you know, 375, 380, you know, this time. And he's one who helps finance, helps the Jews begin rebuilding the temple so that, you know, he's anti-Christian. So he's trying to help rebuild it. So they actually started rebuilding the temple, and he's a full-out pagan. And that would be like the grandson of Constantine. That's how the church began to behave. Once they got out of persecution, they started persecuting each other. And then, even in Constantine's, guys like Arian and Athanasius, you know, was Christ created Arianism, or Athanasius? No, he was God. Well, when the Arians were in power, some of Constantine's sons were Arians, then they'd put Athanasius in exile, you know, and so he's a Christian, he's a Christian leader. So they're exiling, it'd be like the Calvinists, you know, exiling those that disagreed with them, or me exiling the Calvinists or something. And so that's how the church began to behave. So, I mean, that's an insight. But it is amazing how Islam just marched across the land, how fast it spread. Yep. And forced conversion. And they're a law to themselves, meaning they, you know, their practice of war, rape was part of, that was part of the plunder. I mean, and so it was a very barbaric, and it's hard to, and the difference between Christianity and Islam, I can say this, is as a Christian with a Bible, I can criticize behavior of Christian empires and Christian emperors who were slaughtering and raping in the name of Christ or the name, because it's like, no, that's, we renounce that. Where, and the scriptures renounce that. Where Islam and the Quran, they preach that. You say, well, I'm gonna live as a Muslim just like the Quran. Well, that's what they do. I mean, yeah, that's the way it is. Yeah, exactly. We kill. We don't kill anybody. Christians are not supposed to be killing people. I mean, we're not supposed to bomb abortion clinics. We may be against abortion, but the answer is not bomb abortion clinics. The answer is to shine the light, proclaim the truth. In our country, you know, protest, you know, get legislation, state your faith.
You know that old hymn about honoring Christian soldiers? I never did like singing that because it always did create an image in my head of,
yeah,
holding the,
a little, it's flag too militant. Yeah. And the thing is, you know, as you know, there will be a time for Christian war. But that is not on this side of history. That's when Jesus comes back and he'll trample the nation. He will do the warfare. He judges and makes war. The apostles don't judge and make war.
But that
True. I mean, that's the image of Revelation with the sword of his mouth. But in Zephaniah, it talks about their flesh rotting while they stand. So he may not be using a sword. It may be more of a deconstruction, you know, decreation. Right. But then you also have Judah, when you read Zechariah, they'll meet in Revelations, they meet. You know, they meet the Lord on Mount Zion, the ones coming from the wilderness, which maybe are matched up with those in Zechariah. And they fight, and they get credit for the battle. They fight hand to hand. They do armor. So the battle of, like, Armageddon is not just the nations fighting. It's, well, they're coming to bring deliverance to Jerusalem. So we'd have to look at it again, but I think there's going to be hand-to-hand combat because Israel, when they come, you know, they meet the Lord. They don't just walk into Jerusalem and, like, enter the kingdom. They deliver Jerusalem from the enemy by fighting. And we had to read. I mean, I'm not sure what time it is. We don't have time, but chapter, what is it, 13 and 14, and there Zechariah describes the battle.
In real time and in real manner, but that happens before he returns with the saints, doesn't it?
I don't. But we'd have to talk about it because I mean, and again, who is this coming forth from Bozrah? He comes from Bozrah, and his garments stained in blood, and he's won some battle down there by himself, but on that way. They march with him. He brings those in the wilderness, the Jews that he's marked, and they've been hiding in the desert for 1,260 days, whatever it is. Right. And then read Zephaniah and some of the, and then they march up, and Isaiah, because they talk about it. And then they march on Jerusalem, because remember in Zechariah, Jerusalem will be plundered, you know, and half the city will be taken, and the women will be raped. But the Lord goes out and fight against those nations like he fights in the day of battle. I mean, his feet land on the Mount of Olives, and he goes out and fights in the day of battle. And now he's coming down on Mount Zion. And see, but he's coming out of Edom, out of Saudi Arabia, marching. So it's like, I mean, it's not like you've got multiple comings. But you've got him appearing, getting these people and coming. And when the Jews, they're not spiritual beings. They're humans who have not been resurrected. They're saved, but they're in the wilderness being protected for that last 3.5 years. And they march and they do battle, and they don't do battle until he arrives. I mean, they're not fighting their way. They're not fighting their way to Jerusalem, and then the Lord comes. Oh, yeah, nice job. I mean, the reason they're fighting is they're fighting. They meet him. Even in Revelation, these 144,000 standing with the Lamb on Mount Zion. And, it's in heaven. Well, the problem is he's on earth. And the 144,000 never went to heaven. They went to the desert. And they came out of the desert to go to Jerusalem, where the Lord came back in Jerusalem, which is Zion. And now they're with him on Mount Zion. And so now they're with him, and they haven't been resurrected yet. Again, in my theology. Exactly. And I haven't done a good job of it. I've tried to read some books. I haven't found anything, but you've got the Battle of Armageddon. You've got the Valley of Jehoshaphat, the Valley of Judgment. You got the Lord coming back on the Mount of Olives, which is Zechariah and the book of Acts talk about. Jesus referred to a parable. You've got him coming out of Bozrah. So you've got him up in Megiddo. You've got him in Bozrah. You've got him doing battle, the blood up to the horse's bridle in Jerusalem. And it's like, and so there's blood. And there, I mean, and even if you'd say, well, he's not going to use a sword, they still, even their horses, their animals rot when in Zechariah. They just melt. So it's like, it's a physical takeover. Well, and the rock striking the bottom of the statue, like we talked about in Daniel chapter 2. It's like, it's...
So
So there is, I think there is that violent taking of the kingdom, but that's the Lord. I mean, and that's not our ministry. There's a time for peace. There's a time for war. And it's like this right now, our time in history is this: proclaim the kingdom is coming. And I think when the Christians understand that and they proclaim that correctly to the world will be frantic, and they will call you, they should call you hateful, violent, insurrectionist, because that's what it is. The Lord is going to take over the kingdoms. The nations of the world will be His. It's not spiritual. It's not in a land far, far away. It's not, you know, with everybody being nice to each other. It's with Him coming back, destroying His enemies, setting up His own kingdom. It's a takeover. Now, that's nothing. We're not going to do that today. To act on, and then you get the cults. Then you know they get twisted and they start trying to do these things that usher in the kingdom. You know, and that's false teaching. They would have to, because they would, before they go into the wilderness, that's when they mourn for Him. They see Him and they mourn for Him as the one they pierced. Now, how do they know Him and see Him? I've explained that the way I've explained it, you know, where it's the second coming in a sense, early in the second half of the tribulation. But at some point, however, they recognize Him. So they do know that, yeah, that He is the Messiah. See, then the Messiah, the whole purpose of the Messiah is to deliver Israel, fight and deliver Israel. And Jesus never once said He's not going to do it. He's just said, not now, not now. All right, I'll pray and take my wife out for supper. Father, we do thank You for the chance to look into Your Word. We thank You for revealing Yourself to us, and we ask that we would handle the things You've given to us and respond to them and process them in a way that will help us grow in faith, to be a better witness, and to be more fruitful for You at this time in history. We do ask that You'd keep us from being deceived and reveal to us errors in our own ways, but also expose areas of darkness that we can avoid them and walk in Your light and continue again to be fruitful at this time in history. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank You for Your patience.